Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, ecumenism, English in the liturgy, and enclosed within the convent walls. On our view from Westminster this week, we catch up with all the news from the Catholic world in the United Kingdom. Denied the right to be a child, millions of children all over the world are still working in difficult and dangerous conditions with no rest, no pay, no recreation or education. On this International Day Against Child Labour, we find out how we can help put an end to such modern-day slavery. And Pope Benedict marks the Feast of the Holy Trinity, looking ahead to the celebration of Corpus Christi later this week. Welcome to the programme. Monday, June 12th, marks the International Day Against Child Labour. An estimated 126 million children across the globe are currently working in dangerous or unhealthy conditions. That's one in every 12 of the world's children aged between 5 and 17 years old. Girls as young as 6 are forced to work as domestic servants in West Africa. Boys as young as 4 are trafficked to be used as camel jockeys in the Gulf States. And in South Asia, children are used as bonded labour in dusty brick kilns. They're forced to work long hours in brutal conditions and are denied all rights to education, rest and recreation. The International Labour Organization Convention on the Worst Forms of Child Labour spells out steps governments need to take to end this kind of work that is so harmful to a child's health and welfare. Yet even in countries which have signed the convention, children continue to suffer exploitation and abuse in homes, in fields and factories, or out on the streets.
The worst part about what they do is what you can't see. It's their separation from their families, the fact that they're isolated, they're discriminated against, they're confined and they have lost their freedom, really.
Jonathan Blagborough is an expert on child labour with the world's oldest human rights organisation, Anti-Slavery International.
I think what's important for us is that we need to concentrate on these very worst forms, what we would consider to be child slavery. While people are very happy to work on issues around child labour in the mines and construction industry and commercial sex exploitation and things like that, people are tending to ignore some of these other child slavery issues, like children who are labouring to pay off family debts, children who are working as domestic servants, children who are forced to beg or trafficked for use as camel jockeys, for example. And we really want people to understand that, you know, these are just the very worst cases that we need to focus on.
These are perhaps the cases that it's most difficult to get accurate information about, because so much of this is very difficult to monitor, isn't it?
That is very true. It is very difficult to find out about these. These children are very hidden. They're very isolated. And I think that's one of the reasons why child slaves are often ignored, because the worst part about what they do is what you can't see. For example, I've recently come back from Togo and I met a 13-year-old girl there called Amevi, who had been trafficked to the capital for child domestic work. And she's doing, you know, housework, cooking, cleaning, washing, ironing, childcare. But one of the most frightening things was her dependence on the employer and how isolated she was, which meant that she ended up being beaten and quite badly abused, and ended up being thrown out onto the street.
In what ways is anti-slavery trying to tackle this problem? Is it really working with the children to make them aware of the kind of rights they have and should be able to enjoy? Or is it continuing to try and raise international awareness of this problem?
It's both. We have, for example, successfully lobbied for laws to prohibit child slavery. Most recently, we managed to push through a law in the United Arab Emirates to stop the use of children as camel jockeys. But also it's about improving direct services for children to improve their lives directly, providing them with education through our partners, you know, giving them shelter, giving them legal and psychosocial support, which better protect them from exploitation.
Another area that we don't hear so much about anymore is the whole problem of child soldiers, children being caught up in conflicts in many different countries around the world today.
Yes. Children caught in armed conflict, whether they're soldiers or whether they're being forced to provide services for the army or sometimes being forced as sex slaves for the soldiers, is one of these issues which comes up in many different countries. We've got a lot of conflicts going on, and this has a particularly bad impact. Especially, it's not just about the scars that they have and the danger of their job when they're doing it, but the psychological scars that are with them for the rest of their lives.
Now, all these forms, these worst forms of child labour, are actually outlawed. Children should be protected by the UN's Convention on the Rights of the Child. And yet, why is it that it is so difficult to monitor and stamp out this kind of problem?
As I said before, it's very hidden. It's also that governments feel that they have other priorities. Sometimes people are just not aware of these issues going on. And sometimes, as in the case of children who work as domestic servants, there's a perception that this kind of work is actually not so bad for children, that there, you know, there can be a benefit for them. From our point of view, that's a total myth. And what people need to understand is the exploitation and abuse which these children are suffering from. But often it's that children are physically hidden, but also they're hidden in people's minds, and people just aren't seeing these abuses of child workers.
The perception would be that many of these children are actually a vital part of the family income, helping to support families and communities.
Yes, that is exactly right. And certainly employers, for example, see that they're actually helping a poor child, that they're providing a benefit. They may be giving a small income or just giving food and shelter for that child, and therefore helping the child and the family. However, the actual, when you look into it, the actual benefit to the child is nowhere. The child is denied education. The child is not being given any useful skills which will help them in later life. And they're just being used and being exploited.
Can you give us some examples, perhaps, of places or situations in which your organisation has been able to really make a difference? You mentioned the case of the camel jockeys in the United Arab Emirates, but maybe particular cases of children who you really have helped to get away from this kind of exploitation and abuse that you're talking about.
Yes, I can tell you, for example, about this 8-year-old boy that I met relatively recently from Pakistan, a boy called Iqbal, who was working in the training camps, training to be a camel jockey at 7 years old in the United Arab Emirates. You know, when we found him, he was beaten regularly. There was sexual abuse going on in the camps. He was isolated from other children of his own age, and he was, you know, one very scared child. What we've been able to do, along with other organisations, is to be able to get him back home. But not only that, but actually to be able to provide him with opportunities, which means he won't be re-trafficked. The other place that I work in quite a lot is the Philippines. And one thing that we've been doing there is helping the local partner to be able to run sort of halfway houses and shelters. That when children come off the ships, when they're coming from different parts of the Philippines, they're sort of stopped in order that they aren't trafficked into all kinds of nasty things going on in the capital, in Manila. And so, you know, helping that organization to be able to improve the work that they do. We also, I mean, where we do most of our work is on campaigning. And, you know, that's certainly the message that I would have for your listeners is, the most important thing of all for the public is to stand up and be counted. But one of the interesting things that we have been doing is getting campaigners to write letters in the Philippines to try and pass legislation to protect child domestic workers. And it was interesting, I was recently in the Philippines, and the aide to the senator who we'd been getting letters written to told me in confidence, he was saying, look, can you stop these letters, please? Because the senator was shocked to see all these letters coming from all over the world. But what he let slip was that it strengthened the senator's resolve to push the legislation, because the senator's just thinking, this isn't just a Philippines issue. Other people are watching us. And I think that's, that's a very important part of what we do, is actually making sure that governments and others realize that the world is watching them.
Jonathan Blagborough there of the London-based Anti-Slavery International. Ecumenism, we're often told, is a one-way street. There's no going back. But has that journey now hit a dead end as far as Catholic relations with the Church of England are concerned? This stark warning is the way some observers are seeing a recent address by the Vatican's top ecumenical expert, Cardinal Walter Kasper. He was speaking at a private meeting of the Church of England's bishops discussing the ordination of women to the episcopate. Plus, are the Catholic Church's liturgy wars finally coming to a close? And behind the scenes in The Convent, the latest religious reality show hits Britain's TV screens this week. Well, here with more on all of those stories is our regular guest, Austin Ivory, Director of Public Affairs for the Diocese of Westminster. Austin, welcome to the programme.
Good to be with you.
I'd like to start with those recent remarks by Cardinal Walter Kasper. Now, I haven't seen much coverage of this story, but it really was a very dramatic warning about the future of Anglican-Catholic relations if the Church of England decides to go ahead with the ordination of women bishops.
It was very strong stuff indeed. Cardinal Kasper has been sounding these warnings with greater and greater emphasis. He gave a speech last year in Durham which said a lot of what's in here, but I've never heard such stark, straightforward language being used. He was invited to tell the Church of England House of Bishops exactly what the implications for our ecumenical relations would be if the Church of England, as it is planning to, proceeds towards the consecration of women as bishops. And Cardinal Kasper accepts the invitation and does say in a very, very straightforward way, simply, if this does happen, then we can no longer talk about the path of ecumenism, which was the path towards full unity and communion, which was launched by the Archic process 30 years ago. Frankly, that will come to a halt. And then he says, of course, we will continue to have friendships, and we will continue to work together where we can, and pray for each other, and so on. But the big difference, he's saying, is that we would no longer be moving towards each other, but rather we'd be coexisting alongside one another. In other words, the relations with the Catholic Church and the Church of England would become very similar to the relations that the Catholic Church has with, with Protestant churches in general. In other words, no effort ultimately to seek full communion, because the theological and ecclesiological differences are too stark.
And yet, as we all know, at least three of the world's Anglican provinces have already agreed to consecrate women as bishops. Why is he making these comments, do you think, particularly to the Church of England?
Well, this is, of course, a vital question. If members of the member churches in the Anglican Communion already have women bishops, then what's the big deal? Why should it be so different for the Church of England? But he addresses this exactly halfway through the speech when he says that the Catholic Church has always perceived the Church of England as playing a unique role in the Anglican Communion. And he gives various reasons for that. But ultimately, he's saying it is the Church of England which exercises the role of koinonia, of communio, within the worldwide Anglican Communion. And therefore, he says that that's why for us the Church of England is not simply one province among others. Its decisions have a particular importance guidance for our dialogue and give a strong indication of the direction in which the communion as a whole is heading. So he's saying, he's accepting, of course, also, as he does earlier in the speech, that the Church of England voted for women priests, and there's obviously a logic in them proceeding to consecrate women as bishops. But what he then goes on to say, having conceded that, is that actually to consecrate a woman as a bishop, and the whole role of the bishop is, of course, central to the whole point about what a church is and the unity. In other words, unity is exercised by a bishop, not just within his diocese, but also with the church as a whole, and therefore to have what the Catholic Church would regard as illicit and invalidly ordained bishops would, of course, spell the end to the prospect of communion between the Catholic and the Anglican churches.
So what kind of reaction have you heard from either from the Catholic Church or from the Church of England regarding these comments? As you say, very strong comments.
I have to say, muted. I mean, only the Times, really, with its assiduous coverage of these things, gave it space. I'd say it passed largely unnoticed by the press as a whole. I think there's, you know, a broad acceptance here that actually what Cardinal Casper is warning against has already happened. In other words, there's no, I think, great expectation. There's no great surprise, perhaps, in the Catholic Church saying this. I mean, for those of us who observe these things, there is a different note, a starkness in what the Vatican is saying to the Church of England. It's very interesting, actually, also to introduce another point here, which is that the Anglican Church, of course, faces this summer vital questions about its own communion, because of the question of the membership of Accusa, the North American Episcopalians who ordained a gay man as a bishop against the warnings of the member church of the Anglican Communion. And the Tablet has a very interesting editorial this week, and I think this is absolutely spot on. He's actually saying that the message that Cardinal Casper is giving to the Anglican Church is really exactly the same message that most of the member churches, including the Church of England, are giving to Accusa. In other words, if you go ahead and do this, then you're breaking up the communion. So there's a kind of contradiction here with the Anglicans, and the Tablet asks very straightforwardly, can they demand that the American Church halts or reverses its moves towards homosexual bishops for the greater good of communio, while the Church of England dismisses an appeal from Rome over women bishops on the same grounds? Or to put it bluntly, the editorial ends, how do they say yes to women bishops and no to gay bishops?
Now, from divisions within the Anglican Communion to divisions within the Catholic Church over the translation of the Missal, this story that has been going on regarding the International Commission on English in the Liturgy. There have been some developments regarding the acceptance of that translation by not only the Church of England and Wales, but also the Church in Australia. And yet the difficulties seem to be continuing, particularly regarding the Church in the United States.
The Catholic Herald this week has a great splash on its front page. Deadlock broken over English Mass. Bishops of England and Wales approve revised draft. And a great picture of Cardinal Pell with his arms raised. And it says here, hail significant vote. Cardinal Pell, the chairman of Vox Clara, which is the oversight committee, making sure that the English-speaking bishops' conferences move forward in the approval of the revised translation of the Mass. Why is all this important? Well, because of what we, I suppose, loosely call the liturgy wars have been going on now for more than a decade. And it's very interesting. I mean, in many ways, the modern Catholic Church, particularly in the English-speaking world, divides over this question. It's the old thing of how faithful is the should the translation be to the Latin, and how faithful should it be to what's called enculturation or the local culture, is only one level of the debate. Underneath that, you've got also controversies over the role of Rome in all of this. And it's quite interesting, the Catholic Herald, which I think has been looking for a decisive intervention from Rome to make the Mass, you know, to make the translation of the Mass more faithful to the Latin, more Roman, if you like. And the Tablet has taken really the other view, which is that this is for local bishops to enculturate the language, and Rome has no right to interfere in this process. And of course, back in 1998, when ICIL, which is the commission of people appointed by the English-speaking bishops' conferences to make the translation, revised what is now the 73 translation, that 98 translation was rejected by Rome, which said, no, that's not faithful enough to the Latin. Then there was this new document introduced called Liturgium Authenticam, and this new translation is based on those principles. So this goes back quite a long way, this issue. Now, everybody's been anxious for this to be solved. We need a new translation. Cardinal Pell's been driving this forward in Vox Clara, and there are now expectations that by the end of the year we will have this new translation. However, even though the bishops of England and Wales, who were have been the first to approve the revised draft, the Australians have done so, but now it goes to the United States. Bishop Arthur Roach, chairman of ISIL, has been in the US this last week. And of course, the US bishops, who are much more divided over it, I have to say, than our own, it really does all now depend on whether they approve this revised draft, in which case I think it's green light. If they don't, however, it's as the Catholic Herald is saying quite well in its leader, we will probably have a continuation of the so-called liturgy wars for some time to come.
So from some very much in-church affairs, if you like, to a much more popular culture issue, the story that you've been following quite closely, haven't you? The question of the television programme, first of all, the monastery, now we have the convent, and we have an interesting preview of that in the tablet this week. Tell us more.
Well, it's all great. This is Big Brother for Catholics. You know, you can despise Big Brother and celebrity, let me get me out of here, and all this kind of rubbish on TV, but you can love the monastery and now the convent. The monastery last year was one of the great successes on the BBC, a three-parter, each one went out for an hour on BBC Two, got 3 million viewers, has changed the face of religious broadcasting. All the TV production companies want to do follow-ups and imitate this. But the basic format of the programme is you take young spiritual seekers, representative, emblematic, if you like, of modern young people, put them in a monastery for 40 days, and they follow very tightly the monastic routine, and you know, see what happens and how they develop. Well, it was done with the monastery just last week, by the way. There was the monastery reunion, which is when those five men got back together at Worth, just sort of, you know, Worth Abbey, by the way, which is where the monastery was set, to discuss progress. And now very shortly, in fact in this week on Wednesday night, we have the convent, which is the follow-up, the female version, and very interesting preview of it in the tablet by Sue Gaisford.
As you say, these are four ordinary women, four women from very different walks of life, who come together at the Poor Clare's Convent in Arundel, and really it's quite extraordinary the kind of transformation that takes place in these women's lives, according to this article.
This happens when you take people out of the hurly-burly of ordinary life, and of course they themselves are looking for something. But one of the fascinations with what everybody would be looking for in the convent is, you know, how is it the same and how is it different? And how is it different for women, and how is it different in this particular setting? I mean, it's interesting, Sue Gaisford says here that the series was entirely made by women, for women. You know, all the camera people were women, and the sound equipment and so on. So no men came into the enclosure of the Poor Clare's Convent in Arundel in the south of England. And so this is really going to be a woman's world exposed. One of the differences that I think the women in this programme regress in a way perhaps that the men didn't, become more childish and more, Sue says here, two of them particularly display an irritating reluctance to put much effort into the experiment and behave in silly ways, smuggling in wine, sneaking off for cigarettes, or racing electric wheelchairs through the garden. And then she says actually the nuns get quite exasperated with them and say, look, you know, you've got to take this seriously if you're going to get anything out of it. And the other observation that they make is, I mean, they say it's quite different from the monastery, in the sense the monastery was filmed in the summer, Arundel in winter. At Worth, the visitors had their own separate house where they lived. At Arundel, they're right in among the nuns. So there are obviously these differences, but she says the most striking difference is that the seekers at Arundel, at the Poor Clares, prove all to have been damaged by difficult and broken sexual relationships, whereas none of the men visiting Worth so much as mentioned the opposite sex. So there's, you know, while the men in the monastery were on their journey and had to expose their vulnerability, funnily, if they didn't ever talk about relationships, where clearly the women in this programme are going to be talking at length about painful experiences in their past. And Sister Elred of the Arundel Poor Clares offers an observation, which is, I think, very interesting. She says, my experience of men is limited, but women seem to need to grapple with relationships, while a lot of men don't go there. They find it too painful. They show their vulnerability in other ways.
And it seems that despite what one might think of perhaps of these sisters living in a very enclosed environment, not exposed to the problems of relationships and family life, somehow it seems that it's going to be a bit of a surprise the amount of insight they have into these women's relationships their problems.
I think this is the great value of these programmes, is that it opens up the world of monasteries and convents for millions of viewers who would regard them as very odd places where odd people live. And many people said that one of the great effects of the monastery was to realise just how normal, I mean, it's very patronising, is what people have been saying, just how kind of normal the monks were. And I'm sure that, I haven't seen the convent, but I'm sure it will reveal that these religious women really are full of wisdom and insight and articulate and, you know, and holy in the sense that's very recognisable by the world, compassionate, loving, you know, full of those things which if you like, show that the gospel really works.
BBC Two, 9 p.m, The Convent on Wednesday, June the 14th. For the moment, Austin, thank you for being with us on today's programme.
Thank you.
Austin Ivory is Director of Public Affairs for the Archbishop of Westminster, Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor. And finally, here in the Vatican on Sunday, Pope Benedict marked the Feast of the Holy Trinity, likening the mystery of the triune God to that of the family, a community, he said, of love and life. The Pope also looked ahead to this Thursday's Feast of Corpus Christi, urging Romans and tourists alike to participate in the liturgical celebrations that take place in the city centre. My colleague Charles Collins has all the details.
Forty 40,000 people packed St. Peter's Square on Sunday to hear Pope Benedict XVI's Angelus message. On the Sunday after Pentecost, the Church commemorates the Holy Trinity.
Today we celebrate the great solemnity of the Most Holy Trinity in praising the Father who sent into the world the Word who is truth and the Spirit who makes us holy. Let us strengthen our commitment to bear witness to our faith, bringing Christ's good news to our families, our workplaces, and all whom we meet.
Pope Benedict said that among the many analogies of the mystery of the one and triune God, he wished to talk about that of the family. He said the family is called to be a community of love and life, in which diverse people must come together to form a parable of communion. The Holy Father said that the entire universe, for those who have faith, speaks of the one and triune God. From the solar systems to microscopic particles, all that exists goes back to a being who communicates through a variety of elements, like an immense symphony, in which all beings are arranged according to a harmonic dynamism that we can call love.
Giovedì prossimo, 15 giugno, avrà luogo a Roma la tradizionale processione del Corpus Domini.
After reciting the Angelus, Pope Benedict invited the people of Rome and pilgrims visiting the city to join him in the traditional Corpus Christi procession on this coming Thursday. The procession follows the Pope's Mass at St. John Lateran Basilica and goes down Via Marilana to the Basilica of St. Mary Major. There, Pope Benedict will give his benediction. I'm Charles Collins.
And that brings us to the end of today's programme, but we'll be back on the air at this same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. Don't forget you can find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org and click on the English icon. Stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.